This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Ben Bernanke said in a speech today, the logistics of rescuing this economy are hard. On this program, then, what happens if we don't get that right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 7th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The animating idea of the program today is this. It's just hard to shovel $2 trillion into this economy on a couple of weeks' notice. And that difficulty brings delays. Delays that, as you are going to hear throughout the broadcast, are bringing real problems to people and companies, and maybe eventually to the economy, too. Item one, small businesses. This past Friday was the first day that those businesses could apply for loans under the rescue package. Marketplace's Justin Ho spent that day talking to business owners and lenders, and things weren't going so well. So we asked him to check back in today for an update.
On Friday, when I talked to Chris Duncan, a senior loan officer at LaSalle State Bank in Illinois, he said businesses had been looking for details about the loan program all week, but the bank didn't have them.
The president of the bank has been on hold with the SBA hotline. Oh, I bet you it's about 3.5 hours now.
When I got in touch with him today, Duncan told me that when his boss finally got through, he didn't get many answers either. But that was Friday.
Since that time, we got access to the SBA system where you input the applications that you have, their portal.
LaSalle State Bank has approved 41 loan applications so far. But Duncan says it can't start handing out checks until it gets some guidance from the SBA on the details of the loan contracts it should use.
It's the loan documentation, the actual promissory note that you might need to sign. What language does that need to have in it?
On Friday, a big bank approved an application from New York bar owner Ashwin Deshmukh. But he doesn't expect to see any of the money until next week. And that has him wondering whether he should apply to other financial institutions.
We just internally have to set a deadline by which we've got to hear back from our existing financial institution, or we have to start shopping more nimble and smaller options.
Other businesses haven't even gotten that far along in the process. John Resnick owns Proforma, a Boston-based marketing company. Last week, he hadn't heard back from his credit union. Last night, it finally sent an email saying it was accepting applications.
And now we're just back in the waiting game.
And back in the dark, hoping the situation sorts itself out. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Quick update to that small business loan program Justin was talking about. The White House seems to know it is going to take more money to stabilize small businesses. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is asking Congress for another $250 billion to be added to the original $350 billion for the loan program. Vote, I think, on that comes on Thursday. One of the ways that businesses, big and small, are getting extra cash as revenues fall through the floor is through lending programs that are being set up by the Federal Reserve. Mary Daly is the president of the San Francisco Fed, one of the earliest of the regional Fed banks to start seeing economic peril from the coronavirus. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
You have seen, I'm sure, the dire predictions. I'm sure you were in the room, actually, when many of them were formulated. What are you seeing out there in terms of where this thing is going right now?
Well, I'm seeing that the American people are doing the right thing for public health and sheltering in place. And this has caused a hard stop on the economy, on economic activity, and millions of individuals are losing their jobs, and some of them are shuttering their businesses. And this is really challenging, but it's also temporary. And the more we get the virus under control, the more likely we are to be able to come back to work.
A word here about your background as it relates to this crisis, because one of the things that's becoming clear is that this crisis is not hitting everybody equally. And by that, I mean low-income people, minorities,
people who are dispossessed of economic power in this country are suffering disproportionate amounts. And you come from a background where you worked your way up. You're not a conventional choice for Federal Reserve president. You dropped out of high school. I wonder what your empathy level is for those people who are being hurt so badly but don't have a voice.
Well, my empathy for those who don't have an equal footing is always high. But all you have to do is look out my window in Oakland, California, and see the numerous small businesses who employ one or two people and realize those people aren't working. They're under tremendous stress because they're worried about their health, and now they're under tremendous stress because they're worried about their finances. And this is why each one of us in the economy has a role to play. Even if you're not a policymaker, you can pay for services that you would normally get and try to help those individuals who we rely on every day keep some level of income so that they're as well prepared to come out of this as we are, who are lucky enough to telework.
Are you working from home now, by the way? Or are you in your office or are you in your home?
I'm completely at home. It actually is super hard for me not to be in the office because we have essential staff doing important work. But I know that the best way to keep them safe is for me not to be near them. So I send them virtual hellos and I stay at home and work here like, you know, I'm supposed to.
One of the things your staff has been working on, I guess this came out a week or so ago. San Francisco Fed came out with a report on uncertainty in this economy and the coronavirus. Basically, we don't know what's happening. There's mass unemployment. Things could get desperately worse. I wonder how confident you are in that prediction.
Well, what I'm confident in is that we are facing something really uncertain, and that is the evolution of the virus. We really don't have control over that, and that makes everyone afraid. And the best treatment for that type of uncertainty is to control the things we can control. It's a painful time, but we can reduce that pain by making sure that we provide some shoring up for people and put them in a good position to recover once the virus is behind us.
You know, it's funny. When we had Chair Powell on the program like a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, one of the things he said was, as you're thinking about monetary policy, control the things you can control. And that's become the mantra around the office a little bit. It's, you know, control what you can control. And I wonder how you control things right now when everything is so out of control, if that makes any sense at all.
It makes complete sense. I mean, I'll tell you what I tell my 1,700 employees and the more than 20,000 people who work in the Federal Reserve System. What we control is we can be the best in public service. These are challenging times, and we all need to show up, and that's what we can control. Show up to work every day, show up and do your jobs, ensure that you're being part of the solution by sheltering in place. Even if you do something small, you're part of the solution, and that's what we can control.
Mary Daly, she's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. President Daly, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Traders today thought they had things under control, and then they didn't. Big rally at the open, and then it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last week on the program, we asked a somewhat loaded question given the current state of economic affairs. When, we wanted to know, does a recession turn into a depression? In search of an answer, we convened an informal panel of sorts, economic historians, who told us what to look out for.
Unemployment, of course.
Unemployment claims.
The unemployment rate.
Credit delinquencies.
Credit markets.
Credit for small businesses.
Significant and prolonged deflation.
Declining prices.
And bankruptcies.
That was Kathleen Day from Johns Hopkins, Carola Friedman from Northwestern, and Eric Hilt from Wellesley. So what we are going to do today and over the next couple of days is take each of those indicators they mentioned in triplicate there, unemployment, credit, and deflation. We're going to go over the basics and see where things stand right now. First up,
significant and prolonged deflation.
The textbook definition of deflation is when the rate of inflation, which we measure every month by, among other things, the Consumer Price Index, when that falls below zero and there's a decrease in the price of goods and services across the board over time. Most dramatically, of course, deflation was present in the Great Depression when prices fell by about 30%.
Thing is, prices going down sounds great, right? But when they keep going down, it gets complicated in a hurry. Here's Eric Hilt from Wellesley.
It changes people's expectations.
People's expectations. People being consumers, expectations being what we expect to pay. Let's say I'm in the market for a TV, right? And I've got my eye on one that costs $500. But I look around and I see prices on pretty much everything are going down, deflating. So you know what? I'm actually just going to wait until that TV drops to $400. But then when it hits $400, prices are still going down. So I'm going to wait some more. In the meanwhile, the electronics store I was going to spend my money in is taking the hit because all of a sudden that TV isn't worth on the open market what they paid for it.
So deflation is particularly painful for debtors.
And it's not just retail that gets hit, because be it a car or a house or whatever, consumers have debt too. Here's Carola Friedman.
The value of your house declines, but the value of your mortgage does not. And so that, again, puts a lot of strain on households.
Yes, the idea of everything losing value is definitely scary. But, and it's important that you hear this, we are not, repeat, not seeing deflation in this economy right now. In fact, the next official measure of where prices have been headed, and that is generally, if weekly, up, is the Consumer Price Index, and that will be on us Friday morning. So that is deflation. Tomorrow, as our panel suggested, unemployment, a depression, and what to look for. Time is money, it's often said, and that's becoming more tangible the longer it takes the administration to get that $2 trillion out into this economy. Rents aren't being paid, which means landlords are falling behind on their mortgages, which is, for some, in that unkind way that capitalism works, an opportunity. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what those with the capital are seeing in real estate.
During the last financial crisis, there was a lot of distressed property to be had in South Florida. Daniel Levinson, co-founder of the investment firm BH3, says buying that distressed debt built the foundation of his company. He says nobody feels good about taking advantage of misfortune, but firms will be looking at this pandemic in the same light.
Now is the time to innovate and go hunting, because there will be opportunities.
But the market changes will come in two phases, according to KC Conway, chief economist at the CCIM Institute.
Phase one is really a repricing opportunity. And I think then the acquisition comes a little bit later, maybe 6 months down the road.
Because he says the real estate market moves slowly, and we're only a month into this pandemic. Jim Costello is senior vice president at Real Capital Analytics.
It's not as if anybody who owns anything is suddenly going to step up and say, oh, sure, a month ago, I could have sold this building for $400 a foot, but because I'm afraid of what's happened in the market, you could buy it for $200 a square foot.
Though he says we could get there at some point. Calvin Schnurr, a senior economist at NAREIT, says the first real estate sector to have to sell on the cheap will likely be hospitality.
Some of the areas like the hotels and the travel related, the restaurants, many of those are fairly tight on their cash flow and could actually be facing a situation where they need a buyer fairly soon.
And he says one part of the market that many viewed as fairly safe, retail office space, could be compromised because so many people have learned to work from home. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In apples, for example, we saw a pretty significant spike.
Can't tell the trees not to grow, can you? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 26 points today at 10%, 22,653. The NASDAQ off 25 points, 0.3%, 78.87. Neatly palindromic there. The S&P 500 shaved 4 points, 0.1%, 26.59. Almost calm, it seems, doesn't it? Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund bought an 8% share in, wait for it, hold on, get this, in the cruise line company Carnival. Today on Word of That, Carnival sailed up more than 10% today. Go figure. Royal Caribbean or Royal Caribbean, take your pick, found more than 13%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So here is a change to the American labor force that I'm not sure a whole lot of people saw coming. A whole lot of jobs that used to be safe aren't now because of the coronavirus. And more of the people who have those jobs, jobs that have been declared essential, are demanding hazard pay. Some companies have bumped hourly wages. Yes, some grocery chains, for instance. But who gets hazard pay and for how long? Is a question more and more businesses are going to have to answer. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
Hazard pay is a squishy term. Whether work is hazardous is pretty much up to individual companies to determine. Jennifer Trivedi is an assistant professor at the University of Delaware's Disaster Research Center.
The tendency is for hazard pay to be focused on employees who are exposed to things in the course of their work.
Like if your company sends you to a war zone. But COVID-19 has changed what's considered hazardous. Jonathan Siegel is with the law firm Duane Morris and advises businesses on issues like this.
It's not just healthcare. It's those courageous people that are working in supermarkets and pharmacies. They are taking risk to keep all of us alive.
And that can be said for lots of workers these days. Monica Moody is 22 and works as a packer at an Amazon warehouse in North Carolina.
My role has changed dramatically. Like, I have to be even more careful than what I already was being inside of that building.
Moody is a member of United for Respect, which is calling for better working conditions and pay. Amazon has temporarily added $2 an hour of additional pay for workers. Moody thinks it should be permanent. And that, says Trivedi, is an issue for any company thinking about hazard pay.
How do you decide that the risk has reduced enough that you no longer need hazard pay?
And even if a company decides it's safe, will workers be on board? In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We now return you to the through line of the program, what it means for reals that relief and rescue money isn't getting out into the economy fast enough. 10 million people have lost their jobs in the last couple of weeks, at least 10 million, I ought to say, because it's really hard to get an accurate number right now. State unemployment systems are overwhelmed. There is confusion about who's eligible and how people can even apply. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
Diane Swan has never applied for unemployment and never thought she'd have to until a couple weeks ago when her state ordered non-essential businesses to close. As an independent hairstylist in Oklahoma City, she doesn't pay into the unemployment system, so she typically wouldn't qualify for benefits. But she'd heard the new law would cover her, so she got online right away and applied.
But I was denied because I'm self-employed, and I was a little baffled.
She's spent hours on the phone trying to sort it out, to no avail.
Oh, my goodness. Probably, you know, they're just jam-packed.
In California, San Carlos barbershop owner Michelle Connolly got tripped up by the application itself.
First question was, what company did your last W-2 come from? And you can't proceed without filling that out.
Problem is, she doesn't get a W-2 because she's also self-employed. So she just wrote down her own business as her last employer.
You know, it's scary. You're just like, oh, I hope this is right.
State systems weren't prepared to quickly adapt to these major changes in eligibility, says Michelle Evermore with the National Employment Law Project. In fact, the Federal Department of Labor just released official guidance about who actually qualifies Sunday night.
I would advise anyone who's recently become unemployed and thinks that they will qualify for pandemic unemployment assistance to just wait until the state website says that they should apply.
But economist Jesse Rothstein at UC Berkeley says every barrier in this process could hurt.
We definitely think that these challenges reduce the number of people who apply for benefits. They make it harder and they discourage some people from doing it.
And even for those who do get approved, the delays could have big consequences. Hairstylist Diane Swan is already late on her mortgage and has other big bills looming.
It is a lot of stress, but as everybody says, we're all in this together.
She's planning to apply again and hope for the best. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One more item along the same theme. It turns out if you're a small business with venture capital funding, you're actually excluded from that giant pool of loan money. Startups are laying off thousands of people while venture firms try to get that law fixed. Molly Wood talks to one of those VCs on Marketplace Tech tomorrow. Check it out. There's a whole lot more eating at home happening now than there was like 3 weeks or a month ago. I mean, yeah, there's takeout, but that's a fraction, right, of what the restaurant business used to be. And that reality is showing up and down the food and beverage chain. We got Patrick Smith back on the phone for a check-in. He runs the family apple and hops farm up in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. Patrick, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
I will not bury the lead here. Forget apples and hops and the global economy. You just had a baby, man.
Yeah, we did. We had a little girl, Kira, on March 25th. So that's been excellent. Keeping us quite busy.
Everybody's doing all right?
Yep, everybody's doing great. Happy, healthy, and okay. It's a good distraction from everything else going on.
Yeah, I bet. But sadly, a farm and your business does not wait for a baby girl. So how's it going running the farm in a coronavirus economy?
Yeah, it's certainly been a challenge. Yeah, as you mentioned, the plants don't really care that the rest of the economy is shut down. And so, you know, we're considered an essential business by the state of Washington and everybody else. So we're doing everything we can to continue the critical activities that we need to do. But with a lot of added precautions for the sake of our employees and everybody.
Yeah. Can we talk demand here for a minute? What is that looking like? What are your projections in terms of, you know, these crops that are eventually going to come to market, whether the global economy is ready or not?
Yeah, right. So that's the hardest part right now, I think, for anybody in any business is projecting kind of what your demand looks like, for the rest of this year. In apples, for example, we saw a pretty significant spike the week of March 16th in shipments. And the theory, at least for myself, is that that was the week when everybody started going out buying toilet paper, buying all the things that they needed. Apple shipments were actually up 52% that week versus the same week a year prior. But then kind of before and after that week had settled back into kind of on trend over the prior year. So if you want to talk beer.
Of course, Patrick, I want to talk beer. Of course I want to talk beer.
Sure.
Here's the thing. So here I am, sample size of one. I am drinking more beer at home than I used to before all this started, which I'm sure is great for you. But we're not having large public gatherings where people are drinking beer, right?
Right. And so packaged beer sales in grocery stores, convenience stores, outlets like that are up, but probably not enough to cover up for the lost volume on premise. So bars, restaurants, and then high volume accounts like stadiums and airports. That draft business has essentially gone to zero overnight. And so even though we are seeing better volumes through grocery, I'm not sure that it's going to make up for the lost volume on those draft accounts.
Yeah, I don't know that we've ever talked about this before on the air. Maybe we have. I don't know, because we've talked a lot. But your family took some of its hops and started up its own brewery. How are you guys doing on the brewery side?
Yeah, I mean, it's mixed. So we do have packaging and distribution in the Pacific Northwest here. And those volumes have increased over the last month or so, but our bar restaurant business is non-existent. And of course, the longer this goes on, the more challenging it's going to be.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so how much time are you getting off with the baby before you actually have to go back to work?
I'm actually staring at my three-year-old son right now. He just kind of came into the recording studio here, which is my nine-year-old's bedroom.
There you go.
If you give me just 1 second, I can...
Oh, no, it's all good.
Hey, Luke, can I come see you in a second, bud? Thanks. Sorry about that.
Oh, man. Oh, no, it's all good. It's all good. How much time you get off before you got to go back to the grind?
Yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting. We'll see. You know, this is our third child, and I've never actually had paternity leave to speak of. And so
of course,
I'll take as much time as I can and start kind of going back to work here and there over the next week or so and try to keep my distance. But yeah, it's been good.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Patrick Smith, it's a brewing company called Bailbreaker Brewing up in Yakima, Washington. The family farm, the ranch is called Loftus Ranches. Patrick, take care. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a visit from the ghosts of financial crises past. Here's the news item, then the historical reference. Today, President Trump fired the acting inspector general of the Defense Department, a gentleman who had been chosen by his fellow government watchdogs to lead something called the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, the group set up under the rescue package to make sure that $2 trillion isn't being fraudulently spent. Now, the history. Anybody remember TARP and the outrage about the lack of transparency back then about the bank bailout and how then Occupy Wall Street happened and then the Tea Party? Anybody remember that? This is way, way more money. All right, we're done. The Dow Industrial's down 26 points today, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ down 25, 0.3%. The S&P 500 shaved off 4 points, about a 10th percent. Kind of seems like days gone by, those numbers, don't they? Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.